This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. As we've heard in the telling of a rising healthcare economy, we must deal with a number of bewildering paradoxes. One is the Orwellian newspeak that asserts employees are not employees, and so largely unprotected by regulation and collective bargaining. Another is that, on the one hand, from the manufacturing days, healthcare evolved into an entitlement. But on the other hand, it is propped up by exploiting the labor of the very people made vulnerable by the death of manufacturing. The median wage in the United States for nursing assistants, phlebotomists, medical assistants, and home health care aides in 2019, according to Brookings, was $13.48 an hour, $28,000 a year, just above the poverty line of $26,500 for a family of four. This on top of brutal shift schedules and sometimes harsh working conditions. Gabriel Winant introduces us to a UPMC worker named Nyla Payton.
Nyla Payton is a medical assistant working for the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. She helps people call in, make appointments, and understand things the doctor said. I asked her, are there primary conditions you hear from people about? She said, black lung and mesothelioma. Both pathologies caused by living in the kind of ruins of industrial capitalism. You know, her phone rings and rings and rings. There's no one but her to take those calls. The damage that one economy did to a whole set of bodies appearing in the form of mesothelioma and black lung was now taking a toll on her body in the form of her having to sit at her desk all day, not able to go to the bathroom because she was trying to take care of those people.
And furthermore, she is in medical debt to her own employer.
So there was this process over the 80s, 90s, into the 2000s of consolidation in Pittsburgh. Big academic hospitals buying up all the little ones. The insurer getting freaked out. So the insurer tries to consolidate and the insurer tries to buy up hospitals and the hospital system by insurance companies. And they try to each not accept payment from the other one to build these monopolies that enable them to keep prices high. If you don't have gold-plated health insurance, as you know, most working-class people don't, the toll of that is going to fall on you. And it's not a perk that these hospital systems give to their workers if they get free care. That's not how it works. And they, as much as anyone, have to bear the brunt of these rising costs, which leave them in these kind of company store-like debt relationships.
Another paradox is the notion of communitarianism, which you invoke at various points. Yet, UPMC Health Systems is something like a $20 billion organization running at approximately a $2 billion annual profit. When community hospitals they acquire run at a loss, management shuts them down, leaving the local community without services, which doesn't sound very communitarian to me. What kind of beasts are these holding companies? Whom do they serve? And to whom did they answer?
UPMC is a nonprofit, as are many of the big academic hospital systems. Cleveland Clinic would be another classic example, which is on and off the biggest employer in Ohio. Johns Hopkins Hospital System in Maryland is, again, the biggest employer in its state. However, these big nonprofit hospital chains have come to behave in very market-conscious ways, right? They're very, very concerned about accumulating and maintaining market share, about having leverage over insurers, and about holding wages down. It's not as though they have shareholders in the same way as a for-profit corporation might, but it's difficult to figure out how to distinguish them from a for-profit corporation. There's a story I tell in the book. A new accountant has been hired at one of the kind of more successful hospitals. He says to his boss, hey, I'm looking at the account sheets here, and, you know, I'm seeing something funny. It looks like here is all of the revenue that we're making beyond our costs. Isn't that what we would call profit? His boss says, no, 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 that's not profit. That's net aggregate revenue after losses or something like that. The accountant says, I don't understand why we're using eight words and we can use one.
From wages to publicly financed debt to the dubiousness of growth as a measure of success, it makes you wonder, the city that likes to think of itself as the miracle on the Monongahela, miracle?
I'm sure you've heard someone say this, right? Oh, it's great now. It's had this recovery. There's all these young people. There are these tech companies. There are neighborhoods in Pittsburgh where you can buy a $16 sandwich. Now, to the broader thing that I think you're getting at in your question, we are undergoing a kind of polarization of the entire economy. There are some sectors that generate a lot of profit, you know, attract a lot of capital, but don't generate a lot of employment. You know, in Pittsburgh, because of Carnegie Mellon, there's a lot of robotics and this kind of thing. And that's a big source of the city's story of its own recovery. But, you know, not that many people in the grand scheme actually work in that industry, but not in this country. So the industries like tech, like finance, that are major drivers of profit and accumulation are not drivers of employment. And the industries that are big drivers of employment, like healthcare, are actually not major centers of profit. Generally speaking, hospitals and nursing homes are actually pretty low margin operations. So employment is on one side, and profit and accumulation are on another side. And the two are not necessarily so directly linked as we might once have thought.
If the trilemma you mentioned dictates that payrolls must be suppressed to achieve low unemployment and affordable public expenditure, how to de-impale the health economy from the horns of the trilemma?
I think there's a lot we can do, encouraging unionization, you know, raising staffing mandates, you know, improving safety standards. There's a lot that would improve working conditions and caring conditions in the immediate term. But until the provision of care is extricated from the logic of market discipline, then the question of how to make either patients or workers or both pay for it is going to recur and recur and recur. But once you're talking about what we call decommodifying or socializing so large a sector of the economy, I mean, you know, $1 trillion here, $1 trillion there, pretty soon you're talking about real money. We're not really the same kind of society anymore after we do something like that. You know, that'd be huge sectors of the labor force shielded from the kinds of market pressure that have brought us the bloodbath of COVID-19, just to take the most recent example. So that's really a very big social transformation.
But not a new one, right? I mean, it was a decision made long ago with public education, whose employees do not get free market sorts of wages and benefits, but it's a hell of a lot better than what the healthcare sector enjoys.
Yeah, and it's, I think, the best example we have for what it could look like to allocate care democratically as opposed to through market processes, right? It's not that there's no conflict over allocation of education resources, far from it, obviously, right? We can all easily think in our own community of all of the conflicts over who gets to go to what school and what does the teachers union want versus what is the city saying you can give them, and all of these kinds of things. But these processes are subject to democratic politics, right? People actually can organize and they can agitate and they can vote, they can unionize, they can do all kinds of things, they can protest, and it affects how education is provided. It affects teachers' working conditions, it affects the conditions under which students learn. And I think it's very difficult to say that both education in terms of students' experience and also as a place to work are not both much, much better for that fact.
It was rejected in the midst of the Revolutionary New Deal. It was rejected in the administration of Harry Truman. It was rejected in the Clinton administration. Some degree of reform was achieved in the Obama administration and was immediately subject to hundreds of attempts at repeal. In the 2020s, gilded or not, do you believe that circumstances have converged to make this politically achievable?
I feel like I can predict with some confidence that the logic of the trilemma, will continue, that we shunt more and more both social problems into the healthcare system and labor into the healthcare system to manage those social problems. As that's the work that people can get, then the health problems associated with economic inequality will continue to persist or get worse, and the cycle will continue and continue and continue, unless there is major political change. There are so many people who have been dragged into this system to work for it and to depend on it for their care. And so that's created these potential constituencies whose scale is just enormous, right? Again, the largest sector of employment in the country. And just think about everyone you know who has gotten gouged by the hospital or by a doctor, right? Who's gotten screwed over by their insurance company. I mean, it's just a kind of unimaginably vast potential constituency. And the question is one of organization. What would it take to articulate the common interest that these millions and millions and millions of people would have in a more humane and democratic care system?
Gabe, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. Really appreciate it. This is a great conversation.
Gabriel Winant is a historian at the University of Chicago. His book is called The Next Shift: The Fall of Industry and the Rise of Healthcare in Rust Belt America. We are left then not with simple answers or immediate solutions, but an understanding of the forces that shaped the sooty Colossus of Steel and manifested again in the antiseptic corridors of healthcare, not ending socioeconomic inequities, but dressing them in scrubs. As the Biden administration dedicates itself to infrastructure, Winant has given us a close look at the decaying steelwork beneath a gleaming economic sector, and at the working class it disserves. But change and political will require a reckoning. Is this the moment? Can we even imagine a day when the looming silhouette of the former U.S. Steel Building casts not a sinister shadow, but is instead a lighthouse illuminating a humane and equitable course? Maybe the question is, how can we not?
Hey, Pittsburgh town, smoke your town, Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh town, smoke your town, Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh town, smoke your town, solid steel from a Keysport town, Pittsburgh, Lord God, Pittsburgh.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Leia Fetter, Michael Lowinger, Eloise Blondio, Rebecca Clark Callender, and doing this week's heavy lifting, John Penrahan. Sandra Ellen writes our newsletter. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson, and our engineer this week was Adrian Lilly. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Bob Garfield. Pittsburgh.